Welcome to the Space Show, Carl.
Well, I've always been a fan of space ever since I started reading science fiction at a very young age, about 9 or 10 or something.
Right. Now, you've been involved in a film called The Living Universe. What's the film about?
It's about how we humans finally get to visit an exoplanet around a nearby star using two technologies. One is artificial intelligence, which we haven't quite got there yet with, because humans are so messy to take care of on a long journey. And secondly, a fusion drive, so that way we get much more speed than we'd get with plain old chemical drives. And so using those two, this shows how we can mount an expedition to an exoplanet and then do some exploring driven entirely locally by the artificial intelligence, because it'd take too long to ask for instructions back on Earth 5 light-years away.
Regular listeners to our show will, of course, know about exoplanets and what they are, but for those who perhaps don't listen so often, what is an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is a planet orbiting around a star which is not ours. So in our solar system, we now have 8 planets. We used to have 9, but Pluto got booted out. We have a bunch of minor planets, asteroids and big rocks and the like. And were there planets around other stars? We've wondered about that for a long time. I actually started a file up on that in 1981, actually, and it took till 1995 before we had the first answer, yes, there is at least one planet around another star. And then we've put up various telescopes with different modalities, and we've been able to find, using the Kepler Space Telescope, that on average, each star has at least 1.6 planets. So that means that in our galaxy, the Milky Way, 300,000 million stars, 400,000 million planets, and there's probably a trillion galaxies. There's a lot of planets out there. It seems to be that that's common. It just took us a while to be able to prove it.
Okay, so every star's got at least one or perhaps two planets, and sometimes as many as 7 or 8.
Yep, I'm quite sure that we'll find that there's more like 3 or 4 on average. But at the moment, there's at least 1.6 per star, 1.6 exoplanets per star. And even the nearest stars around us, the Alpha Proxima Centauri complex, we've discovered there's a planet there as well.
So there are two things that are significant. One is that, first of all, we're seeing these more complex organic molecules, and we're seeing them in a system where planets are forming right now. And that immediately is telling us that when planets form there, they will form in a bath of these complex organic molecules.
The same organic molecules essential to all life on Earth are out there amongst the stars.
Now, artificial intelligence, how does that feature in your film?
Well, the trouble with humans is that they're so messy to take care of. You've got to feed them and put water into them and food into them, and then you've got to get rid of the waste and then keep them running. And things that are surprisingly easy, like breathing, is surprisingly common, surprisingly difficult in space. So, for example, to supply the International Space Station, which most people don't know, has been continuously inhabited since the 2nd of November in the year 2000. To keep people just breathing, we have to go through all sorts of complicated stuff with getting water and then getting electricity, then breaking the water down into hydrogen and oxygen, and using the hydrogen to combine with the carbon dioxide to get more oxygen. It's a really complex process. And every now and then it goes wrong. And so we've got two separate units working on different modalities, one by the Americans, one by the Russians. And so not having humans the first time round, but sending out a robot, and one that can make its own decisions about where to go, where to send down landers, and what sort of vehicles to make, what sort of vehicles to print on the spot, 3D printing, to do the exploring. That has to be done by an artificial intelligence.
There will never be an artificial intelligence system that we will be able to build that will be faultless. So one of the most important characteristics of this autonomous system is to be able to recognize its own mistakes. Talk about being human.
Now, in the film, I understand that there's an imaginary starship which heads off towards one of these exoplanets, and it's piloted by a Captain Artemis.
October 4th, 2157. Launch minus 25 days. I am in the final weeks of construction. More than 1,000 men and women have toiled in space for a decade to build me. My memory fields are online and ready. I am Artemis, the artificial intelligence that will pilot this mission.
Could you tell us about her, please?
Well, she is the artificial intelligence. And so along the way, something goes wrong and she fixes that. And then when they get there, this artificial intelligence then runs entirely everything that has to be done, including the 3D printing of various sort of swim bots and fly bots and drone bots and crawler bots and so forth. And just for a bit of a... Is it okay, Andrew, Dr. Andrew, if I do a little bit of a explanation about 3D printing?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, so 3D printing began back in the mid-1980s as a way of making high heel shoes quickly. So to make a high heel shoe then, just to sort of get a prototype, took you a week and a half and cost $1,500. Today it'd be a lot more cost. And they came up with what they called rapid prototyping, where they had a liquid and they would lay it out in a flat dish, maybe a third of a millimeter thick, and then run an ultraviolet laser beam onto it. And wherever the ultraviolet light landed, that would harden the liquid into a solid. And they'd add another third of a millimetre and repeat and repeat. And finally, when they got to the top, they then pour off all the liquid, and there there'd be a shoe, which cost them $70 and took 3 hours. And today you can easily buy a 3D printer, which will work perfectly well for making cheap little plastic things, and they use as a feedstock PLA, polylactic acid. And they're just cheap little plastic things, and they're kind of fun. We're also today printing stuff that can withstand the incredibly harsh environment of a wind of 1,000 kilometres per hour and a temperature of over 1,500 degrees centigrade. I'm talking about stuff inside a jet engine, a fuel pump. So it's maybe the size of your head. It costs a couple of million dollars. It's got about 20 million elements of the periodic table, you know, the periodic table of all of the elements. It's got about 20 of them. And so they can now print these things, and they're cheaper to print them layer by layer with from individual metals than it is to manufacture them. Mm-hmm. And we're just beginning to get now, for people like you and me, the first metal compatible 3D printers coming through. And the first ones are slow and clunky and expensive, and they'll get cheaper in the same way that phones and computers did. So getting back to our show, Captain Artemis, the artificial intelligence, manufactures some various metal and plastic based objects. She makes these swim bots and the drones and so forth, manufactures them on the spot as needed to do what they have to do. And that's necessary to get us some degree of exploration on this strange exoplanet.
And who plays the role of Captain Artemis?
That's Professor Tamara... Oh, what's her
name? Davis.
Tamara Davis, yes. And she's a real physicist, which is wonderful, as well as being a great voiceover talent. I think she did a wonderful job.
I was about to ask, what's her day job when she's not narrating the film?
Well, doing research into astrophysics. I think she's mainly a galactic archaeologist type person, and also teaching. So she's a full professor, which I'm not. I'm just a low-level academic here at the University of Sydney. She's a full professor, which is a much higher level.
Yeah, and she's Australian?
Yeah, Queensland.
Okay, good. And what's your role on the film?
I'm a voiceover person, so I do the narration. So I've loved science stories for so long. It's just been ridiculous. I've been reading science fiction stories from when I was about 12 or 13, one every day, to when I got to be 32 and I had to stop when I started studying medicine because the body of knowledge I had to take on board was so great I couldn't afford to waste a whole hour a day. And so I've done a fair bit of stuff popularizing science, and so they thought I'd be easy enough to get as a voiceover person, and luckily it all worked out well. Their estimation was correct. I had so much fun doing the voiceover on that.
And who are some of the real-life experts who offer their insights?
There's a mixture of astrobiologists, who are people looking for life either in the solar system or further out, astrophysicists, mission specialists. So there's one person who's been involved with the design and running of 8 missions that landed on other planets or other bodies in the solar system. So we have a whole range of these experts.
The question is, how did we come to be inhabiting this two-dimensional surface on a piece of rock that we call our home, the Earth, near a star like the Sun that is one out of tens of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, that is one out of trillions of galaxies in the universe? How did this all come about? And are we alone in particular?
And who made the film?
Don't know the name of the company. I'm sorry, I failed you on that one.
Okay, but it's Australian made.
It's Australian made. Sorry, the film is Australian made, but they did the rendering, I think, in France. It took about a year to do all the animation. It is really good on the big screen. The animation is absolutely astonishingly good.
So it's a mixture of real people on screen and your computer graphic animation.
Yeah, it turned out really well.
And how can people see the film?
If you just go to Living Universe and search for that on Google, it'll show you where it's searching, where it's playing in a nearby theatre to you, and it's going through the production run right now.
And you're going to be here in Melbourne on Thursday?
I'll be here for the big opening in Melbourne at the IMAX Theatre, which once again is an Australian invention. And so we'll do a bit of an intro, show the film, and then at the end I'll come back and answer questions.
Oh, fantastic. So people should contact IMAX if they want to see you in person?
Sure. And I'm also down there for the Melbourne Writers' Festival, so they can get to see this as easily as well there also.
Now, obviously this theme of interstellar travel, I've always had the view that, at least for humans, interstellar travel is going to be impossible, if not forever, at least for a very, very long time. Do you believe interstellar travel will ever be possible?
You've got to get yourself a big fat power supply. What we have at the moment is fairly hopeless. We've got chemical rockets. Mm-hmm. So somebody gets a big metal cylinder, they fill it full of explosive stuff, put some humans at the pointy end, light the wick, and if nothing blows up, 8 minutes later, you're in orbit around the Earth at 7 kilometres a second, 400 kilometres away. Now, 400 kilometres isn't even the distance between Sydney and Melbourne. You've hardly got anywhere at all. So, and the speed, 7 kilometres a second, that kind of sucks. So what we're proposing, and people are working on this right now, is a fusion drive, a direct fusion drive that uses what the sun uses to get us squirting around quickly in the solar system and then out of the solar system. And here we're talking of speeds of 60,000 kilometres a second. Not 7, but 60,000 kilometres per second. So you ramp up to 1/5 of the speed of light, and after 25 years, you then turn around and turn the rocket around and slow down for the next 25 years. And then after 50 years, you've arrived at somewhere 5 light years away.
Okay. Now, fusion drive, many people would not be familiar with that, but all of my lifetime, fusion has been sort of 30 years away, sort of like the end of the rainbow. You take one step closer to the rainbow and it's one step further away from you. First of all, for those who aren't familiar with fusion, we're talking about the same fusion of hydrogen into helium, as happens in the hydrogen bomb?
And in the sun. The sun burns 620 million tonnes of hydrogen every second. Not 620 tonnes, 620 million tonnes of hydrogen, and turns that into 616 million tonnes of helium. Now, there's a shortfall of 4 million tonnes a second. 1 million tonnes of that appears as a solar wind, which is just charged particles squirted out from the sun. And then 3 million tonnes per second appears as energy, E equals MC squared. Now, you can do fusion of hydrogen into helium on your laboratory bench, or if you want to spend a bit more effort at home. The trouble is you have to put in more energy than you get back, and there's not a useful power supply if you have to put in more energy than you get back. So what they're working on is a way to give you more energy back than you put in. We've been trying on very big schemes, like basically you get big magnetic bubbles to keep the red hot stuff at 15 million degrees confined, or you instantaneously zap stuff with a laser beam, but we're talking a laser beam that puts out the entire power, briefly, of the whole world. And we're working on that, and we've got something like that working in America. The trouble is we still haven't got it to the stage where it will deliver more power than you have to put in. But there are many different approaches now, what they call desktop fusion. And Lockheed is trying one, but I don't know if that one will necessarily work. So it all depends on, can we make fusion work in a sense that we get more energy out than we put in? And if we do that, and I think we will, then suddenly we can scoot around the solar system really quickly. Forget 10 years to Pluto, think more like about 30 hours.
Okay. So we can look forward in the future, maybe, if we can control fusion power, to start scooting off towards the stars.
Well, the American Air Force does have a lovely motto which runs like this: with enough energy, comma, even a pig will fly. So we throw enough money at the problem of getting to the moon, that is to say 2% of the American gross domestic budget, after 10 years we got to the moon. And the payoffs were tremendous, $137 back for every dollar we put in. We invented the integrated circuit, which gave us computers. But today's budget at NASA is down to 1/100 of that, 0.02%. It's microscopic.
Once you set your eyes on a planet out there, Earth-like, in the Goldilocks zone, once we think we have a chance, we will develop the techniques for interstellar exploration. And the payoff, once we get there, is beyond belief.
If we really throw the money at the fusion, we'll become a space-going race. And there are grounds for becoming a space-going race. And the best example of that is the fact that we nearly got wiped out by a big rock on Halloween in the year 2015.
Tell us about that, please.
Well, it was about 1/10 of the size of the rock that wiped out the dinosaurs. So the dinosaurs got wiped out by a rock about 10 kilometres in diameter. Now, a little diversion here. There were other things going on, such as the Deccan Flats in India, D-double-C-A-N, look it up on Wikipedia. But it basically got wiped out by this big rock. Well, a rock 600 metres in diameter, so big that it had its own moon orbiting around us, just missed us on Halloween in the year 2015. If it had impacted the Earth, it would have caused something between 10 to 60% of the human race to die within a couple of hours, depending on whether it landed in a quiet ocean area or a quiet inland area, or, wait for it, perhaps on a potential supervolcano like Yellowstone National Park or Mount Etna. As it turned out, it missed us, hooray. And if it had been on a collision course, if we'd had 3 years' warning, we could have done something to divert it by half the diameter of the Earth, the radius of the Earth, so it would miss us. But we didn't have 3 years warning. We had only 3 weeks. So we have to become a space-going race. Earth has been a very nice cradle for humanity, but at some stage we have to leave the cradle.
At some point, we have to visit the stars. We're never going to just sit here and be content, you know, even when we're visiting the planets, because we want to know what's out there. Everybody wants to go to the stars someday.
Well, I hope people can make it to IMAX on Thursday. And if not then, it will be showing later in September at IMAX.
They'll be having various showings around the country and hopefully going through international distribution. It's a great film. IMAX is perfect because you'll see it on the big screen and suddenly it'll make so much sense.
Well, thank you for joining us on The Space Show, Dr. Carl.
Thank you very much, Dr. Andrew.